Battle of Issus, November 5th, 333 BCE. Alexander III of Macedon, soon to be called the Great, is pursuing the beaten king of Persia across the rough Anatolian country. For the first time in history, a Persian army has been beaten with the king at its head. And at the climax of the battle, Alexander's cavalry had crashed into the Persian center and narrowly missed capturing Darius III outright. As they chase their beaten foe, they cross a small ravine by walking on the bodies of slain Persians and enemy Greek mercenaries as though they are a bridge. But beside Alexander, among the bodyguard companions who he has selected in this pursuit, is a man named Ptolemy. He's also a Macedonian, one of Alexander's closest friends and most loyal generals, a man who had been selected for one of the worst jobs in the battle, to take the punishment on the left flank while Alexander and his troops won the right and center. So this is his victory as well. And though Darius will escape, they have won the western half of the mighty Persian Empire, including Egypt, the oldest kingdom in the classical world. And before their story is over, both Alexander and Ptolemy will be its pharaoh and its god. This episode is brought to you by my buddy Adam Chase from Jetlag's new docuseries, Scav, which follows competitors in the largest annual scavenger hunt in the world. The Ptolemaic dynasty, Egypt's last, would rule over the kingdom for three centuries, bringing about massive cultural changes and the construction of some of the most famous monuments of classical Egypt, such as the Library of Alexandria and the Pharaoh's Lighthouse. During their rule, the city of Alexandria became arguably the intellectual capital of the Hellenistic world, stealing that crown away from the traditional center in Athens. And this success is particularly fascinating, given that the kings and queens of the Ptolemaic dynasty were in fact a Macedonian Greek minority, which managed to retain support from Egyptians over such a long period. And as they did so, the Ptolemies adopted more Egyptian practices while Egypt became more Greek, a process you can trace through art, philosophy, and even burial practices. But we are getting a few decades ahead of ourselves, extra historians. I don't know if you can tell, but I'm very excited for this series. So let's rewind to the aftermath of the Battle of Issus, where Alexander had shattered the field army of Darius III, opening up half of the Persian Empire to Alexander's control. This was a massive victory, far beyond even the wildest dreams of Alexander's generals and his Greek city-state allies. Though it should be noted, this hadn't even really been Alexander's campaign. See, Macedonia was a relatively provincial Greek kingdom, one that was different enough from other Greek city-states that it was an open question whether they were actually Greek. For instance, when Alexander's father, Philip II of Macedon, had gone to the Olympics, he actually had to prove he was of Greek descent in order to compete in the horse race. And there were reasons for that. See, Macedonia was a bit of a political and cultural oddball among its fellow Greek states, where others were democracies like Athens or had a split monarchy with a council like Sparta. Macedon was an out-and-out monarchy in a way other Greeks found uncomfortable. In fact, in both major Persian invasions, Macedon had actually allied with Achaemenid Persia and let their troops cross their land, using this as an opportunity to seize nearby territory. Plus, they were savvy enough that they managed to keep most of that territory after the wars. Meanwhile, their Greek neighbors were also very happy to invade Macedonia, which had some of the best farmland in Greece. Athens had its philosophers, Sparta had its military culture, Macedon had the food. And that is a great thing to have if you want to build an army. So, that is what Philip II did. He reformed the Macedonian army around a core of heavy troops known as the Macedonian Phalanx and extremely specialized, highly trained cavalry. At the same time, he'd trounced other Greek city-states in war, then used marriages and diplomacy to give Macedon a prominent position as the head of an organization he'd formed called the League of Corinth, with the goal of invading the Persian Empire. He also heavily developed his son and heir, Alexander III, hiring Aristotle as his personal tutor and giving him practical experience in both warfare and as regent. The result was that when Philip was assassinated under highly strange circumstances, with some rumors suggesting Alexander was involved due to a dispute over Philip marrying another Macedonian noblewoman, possibly displacing Alexander as his future heir, Alexander basically had a Invade Persia starter kit. He inherited Philip's spot in the League of Corinth, his campaign plans, his military, and his veteran generals. For this reason, there's an argument to be made that Alexander's initial victories over Darius and the Achaemenid Empire were really more of his posthumous father's victories. All Alexander had to do was execute and not screw up, which, to his credit, he did not. Sometimes Nepo babies be talented. But here's the thing. Alexander was not his father. In negotiations, Darius basically offered Alexander the western half of the Persian Empire. And had it been Philip in these talks, he probably would have accepted that. After all, this was success far beyond what anyone had expected. A massive expansion of Macedonian territory. Any other king would have declared victory and gone home. Alexander said no. Because why would he settle for half of the Persian Empire when he could have all of it? Yeah, young Alexander was just kind of built different in a way that historians have never fully figured out. Nothing was just ever enough for him. He'd topple kingdoms and capture territory, then change his goal and insist on moving on to the next conquest. Of course, that didn't mean Alexander was rushing here to confront Darius. He knew there would be years before the Persians could field a major army to confront him again, and he needed that time to consolidate what he'd won. The biggest prize, of course, was Egypt. So, Alexander and his army, with naval support, marched south to the most ancient kingdom in the Mediterranean, not knowing what awaited him. It might have been combat or a rebellion, but instead, he was actually greeted at the border as a liberating savior. Word had reached them of this young dynamic king who had brought Darius to his knees. They'd learned of his victories at Issus and the Siege of Tyre, and heard how he had besieged the fortress at Gaza, breaching the hilltop on the third assault, putting all the men to the sword, and selling the women and children into slavery. Yet despite this, they still did not fear him, even though he still had a shoulder wound from Gaza, which was emblematic of his willingness to engage in violence, because Egypt would hail anyone who brought tears to Persian mothers. Turns out, Egypt had been under Persian rule as a province, or satrap, for about 2 centuries, but they never really jived with the Persians. In fact, there seemed to be some pretty significant religious friction between the Persian occupiers and the Egyptians. Egyptians worshipped a number of sacred animals as representations of the gods, including a bull known as the Apis Bull. About a decade before Alexander arrived, the Egyptians had staged an uprising that was sparked, partially, by Persians killing a sacred Apis bull. In fact, Darius had barely gotten it under control before his defeat at Issus. Yeah, turns out the Persians seemed to be pretty hostile overall to the Egyptian veneration of sacred animals. However, the Greeks, they were all about it. Because part of their belief system was that the Greek gods had traveled from Olympus to Egypt in the ancient past and briefly turned into animals, becoming the gods of the Egyptians. Which is probably why, when Alexander arrived, he immediately made sacrifices to the Apis bull at its cult center in Memphis and ordered the restoration of Egyptian temples that had fallen into disrepair and neglect during the Persian occupation. Egypt was, to put it mildly, a huge prize. Not only did it carry the prestige of great antiquity, after all, the Great Pyramid of Giza was 2,300 years old even then, and its temples larger than anything in Macedon, it was also hugely rich in food. Regular flooding of the Nile brought 3 crops of grain a year, which made it not only a trade powerhouse, but also able to sustain large armies. You know, if, just for example, spitballing here off the top of my head, crazy thought, you were an ambitious young king who wanted to conquer the known world. Now, Achaemenid domination had also given the Egyptian state some advantages, like passing off the lessons of the satrap system with its high degree of organization, professional bureaucracy, and talent for tabulating and managing resources. So Alexander's first goal was to co-opt that bureaucracy by putting Egyptians and Greeks in charge of it and to reform the taxation system under a Macedonian model. He also began plans to found a great new city, Alexandria, on the coast of the Mediterranean. Symbolically, it would represent the point where he took control of Egypt, but practically, it would tie Egypt economically into the Mediterranean trade, and culturally, it would weave it into the Hellenistic world. So he tasked his personal architect, Dinocrates, with the urban planning, laying out a modern Hellenistic grid with water supply and sewage system. But Alexander knew that to actually keep control of Egypt, he would need to become something the Persian emperors never really could, a pharaoh. Not just in name, but also in religious authority. That meant visiting the oracle of Amun-Ra, which admittedly presented a bit of a logistical problem, as he was located in the Siwa Oasis, a vast field of trees and natural springs 350 miles west of Cairo. To get there meant crossing a huge and inhospitable stretch of country containing salt flats, soft sand deserts, and sea marshes that could absolutely not sustain an army. To the south of it was the Great Sand Sea, an area just as deadly. Now, a small party would have a hard enough time getting there, but Alexander had to travel like a pharaoh were he to be greeted and hailed by the oracle as one. That added to the danger, since during the Persian occupation, an expedition to Siwa had simply disappeared into the desert. Again, here it was Alexander's naval allies that saved him. He kept supplied via the coast, ensuring that the hard crossing was made manageable with a logistics chain of food and water. Finally, the dunes and salt flats gave way to the groves of trees clustering beneath the high wadis, the green stretching to the horizon. They'd made it to Siwa. His parched army seeing mud brick homes on their procession as they marched past the necropolis and approached the stone walls of the Temple of Amun with its carved bas-reliefs of the gods. There, the oracle greeted Alexander and took him into the temple alone. Now, what exactly transpired there remains a mystery to this day, since Alexander never even told his closest companions what the oracle said to him. However, when he emerged, Alexander was declared the son of Amun, who the Greeks called Zeus, and he seemed fully set in his destiny. Now, perhaps that's not surprising. See, Alexander had had an extremely close relationship with his mother Olympia, who supposedly regularly told him that he was a descendant of Heracles and therefore Zeus. So it is possible that this simply reinforced a theme already present in Alexander's psychology. Though it is important to note that this was politically savvy as well. Alexander was planning to continue his campaign against Darius and then strike out toward the east. So to keep his new throne secure and its output of grain and funds, he would most assuredly need the type of religious authority this gave him. Besides, in the ancient world, the bounds between man and God were far more fluid than they would be in later monotheistic religions. As a result, Alexander's coronation, where priests bestowed him with the united crowns of Upper and Lower Egypt, also came with the announcement of grand new building projects and the restoration of old temples. Then, Alexander peaced out, along with his captains and generals, to meet Darius in a final confrontation. He would go on to smash Darius and burn the Persian capital of Persepolis, distributing the unimaginable wealth of its charity to his allies and companions, then using the bulk of it to march ever eastward, into Assyria and Babylonia, Central Asia and Afghanistan, on to India, seeking always the great ocean that his tutor Aristotle postulated marked the edge of the world. And at his side, every step of the way, was Ptolemy. Yet, Alexander would not see the great ocean. He would conquer lands and peoples, marry more than once, even wear a skull cap made with an elephant scalp to proclaim his victories in India. But finally, his generals would go no further, and he returned to Babylon. Palace of Nebuchadnezzar, Babylon, June 11th, 323 BCE. Alexander III, the son of Zeus, the great conqueror, is dead. He had sickened quickly, fast enough that many suspected poison, not a strange way for a Macedonian king to die. By some accounts, he spent the previous day unable to speak, weakly waving at his troops as they filed by in a final sign of respect. His body is lowered into a sarcophagus and covered with honey as a preservative. That, in turn, is sealed in a gold casket befitting his greatness. And an enormous cart with a mausoleum atop it would carry it back to Macedon. Alexander's closest companions then gathered to divide the empire. One man took Macedon to supposedly hold it in trust for Alexander's unborn son. One took Thrace and much of Anatolia. Another, Asia. And Ptolemy? the man who would be known as Ptolemy Soter, Ptolemy the Savior, he got Egypt. But he got much more than that. For if Ptolemy had his way, he would have Alexander himself, and the king's body would never reach the shores of Macedon. Kinda seems like a huge historical scavenger hunt, if you ask me. And I know, since you did, it also reminds me of that new docuseries following competitors in the largest modern scavenger hunt in the world that just dropped. Produced by Wendover and directed by my boy Adam Chase of Jetlag fame, Scav captures the University of Chicago's annual 20-page scavenger hunt that plunges students into fun, sleepless chaos. This series throws you right into the action, following three top teams as they race to complete their list, and answers the question of what happens when the best and brightest turn their focus towards the silliest things you could ever see, aka exactly the kind of chicanery that I am here for. And the only place you can see it is over on Nebula, a streaming service a bunch of my creator friends and I helped build. It's a place that we at Extra History do really love because it's an independent platform, not beholden to large media organizations or political policies that might try to influence our shows. It's also a place where everything is made by thoughtful human creators and is free from the onslaught of It's onslaught of AI slop that has taken over YouTube. See, it's invaded my brain too. Plus, on Nebula, you can watch tens of thousands of creative, thought-provoking, and just plain fun videos from 200-plus of your favorite creators early and ad-free. That, of course, includes our huge back catalog of over 1,000 episodes that we have done. So, if you want access to all of this at a great discount, you can go to our link below, go.nebula.tv/extrahistory, if I remember correctly, or you can just scan that QR code here if you're forgetful like me, to get 40% off. That is just $36 a year, aka $3 a month, when you sign up for an annual plan. But this 40% off also works on lifetime memberships, so while the lifetime price did recently rise to $500, as of this time of recording, you can still pick one up with our code for $300. And, of course, if you're using our code on any of those, you directly help out our channel a ton. Thank you so much for that. Again, you can find Scav and Nebula by clicking or scanning here, or stay on the YouTube machine and check out our next video here that will have ads in it. You know what they say, you either die a hero or live long enough to see Angelo Valenciana, Arles Posting, Dominic Valenciana, Hunter Z, Joseph Blame, Kuya Koi, Lotus Wolf, and Zilead's Architectures be the best legendary patrons. That's how the saying goes.